Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dan Fagan, a professor of journalism and the director of the Masters Level Science, Health and Environmental Reporting Program at New York University. The former president of the Society of Environmental Journalists, he is the co-author of Toxic Deception, How the Chemical Industry Manipulates Science, Bends the Law, and Endangers Your Health. And he has just been awarded the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction for his new book, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Fagan.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And your book that just got the Pulitzer Prize is a story of midnight dumping and, I guess, deception in plain sight, and of corporate greed and government neglect, and also a group of extraordinarily courageous, dedicated people who stood up, refused to be silent, and eventually the truth was exposed. So let's begin with the villain, if you don't mind, in this story, which is the Siebert Corporation, a Swiss corporation that have been in this New Jersey shore region, the plants go back to World War II, don't they?
Oh, no, way before that. Let me first take a general issue with the way you phrase the question. SIBA is the name of the company, and to call them a villain would be not really phrasing it in the right way. There are many reasons that things went wrong in Tom's River, and SIBA was certainly not the only source of difficulty. There was illegal dumping in Tom's River. There were lots of citizens who enjoyed the consequences of rapid growth that the industry brought and sort of willfully did not look ahead to the long-term consequences. The water company did a really poor job of protecting its citizens, and state regulators for many, many years really fell down on the job. So there's lots of blame to go around, and it's far too simplistic to just lay it at the feet of one particular company.
Even though they're the source of the pollution?
Well, they're not the only source. There was true that there was a very large chemical factory in town that was operated by SIBA starting in 1952. But there was also a really egregious illegal dump elsewhere in town that contaminated a different set of wells. And both of those Superfund sites, they would later become Superfund sites, were implicated in the health problems that ensued in Tom's River.
So in terms of the managers and the directors and the executives at SIBA, many of them were from Switzerland, right?
Somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Somewhere. And would they have gotten away with what they did in America, in Switzerland, do you think?
Well, again, that's a complex question that's phrased too simplistically. Mm-hmm. SIBA, you know, wound up spending hundreds of millions of dollars. SIBA and or its insurance company wound up spending a tremendous amount of money cleaning up the damage that had been done by that chemical plant. Beyond that, there were two different criminal prosecutions that eventually ended in civil settlements. And a couple of people from the company did indeed wind up pleading guilty. Beyond that, there was a legal negotiation. It wasn't actually a lawsuit, but it was a negotiation involving many of the affected families, 69 families of children who were either sickened or in some cases died from cancers that at least statistically had been associated with pollution in town. And SIBA, you know, was one of the defendants in that legal proceeding. So there were consequences. What I really want to focus on is the idea that, you know, what do we need to do from a prevention point of view to make sure that the Tom's River is the cautionary tale that it really should be? You know, we should be actively looking for these problems and dealing with them. We shouldn't be like the fire marshal, you know, waiting until the house burns down and then trying to figure out what caused the fire. We ought to be focusing on prevention, and there's a lot that we can do.
Again, I'm speaking with Dan Fagan, Professor of Journalism and the Director of the Master's Level Science, Health and Environmental Reporting Program at New York University, the former president of the Society of Environmental Journalists. He's the co-author of Toxic Deception, How the Chemical Industry Manipulates Science, Bends the Law, and Endangers Your Health. And he has just been awarded the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction for his new book, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. But the heart of the story that you've uncovered and written about, Dan Fagan, is a sort of scientific detective story that tries to link cause and effect in terms of cancer clusters that erupted, affecting young children and obviously adults as well, but certainly manifesting themselves in very young people. And that's always been a difficult link to make, has it not? I mean,
Absolutely. That's really the core of the book. It is a quite fascinating scientific detective story that, you know, in a sense has its roots, from starting in classical times. People are trying to figure out the relationship between environmental exposure and chronic disease. It's a very complex problem, but also quite a fascinating one. And epidemiology is something that, you know, people are intimidated by. They think it's too complicated to understand, but it's really about pattern interpretation. It's about how do we interpret patterns. When we see things around us, we see a lot of cases that looks like there are too many cases of a particular kind of cancer, or cancer in general. No, it alarms us. And so epidemiology, one of the most important contributions of epidemiology, is to try to figure out statistically, through a whole series of steps, whether what looks like a cluster is actually has a likely cause or whether it is just random. Because we know that things can cluster for no reason at all. When we see birds flying across the sky, they don't space themselves out evenly. Things cluster. The question is whether they cluster for a reason. It turns out that epidemiology can never tell us certainty about cause and effect, but it is a science of probability. And in other parts of our lives, we act on probability all the time. We can't expect environmental health to, you know, operate, the same way that we would decide a criminal trial, you know, with evidence beyond the shadow of a doubt. Instead, we have to look at the preponderance of evidence, and epidemiology is really good for that. And if we do that, if we reckon. You know, if we accept the reality that we will never know for sure about what caused a particular case of cancer, say, for example, if we accept that reality but then go on to say, well, what do the probabilities tell us based on good science, good epidemiology? Well, we can really protect ourselves in ways that we're really not doing now.
Well, isn't one of the problems, though, and it also manifests itself over this unnecessary foot-dragging over global warming and climate change, that those that are either skeptical or are in outright denial want absolute scientific proof. And it's difficult to, you know, provide absolute scientific proof, even with overwhelming anecdotal information and evidence. And it would seem to me that is also at the heart of your story here, which is that...
It is. It's at the heart of virtually every interesting problem in science that we have. For some reason, you know, when we're living our lives, we routinely act based on probabilities without requiring certainty. And yet, for other kinds of situations, you know, often involving the environment and environmental risk, we say, well, let's not do anything. Let's not try to resolve this problem until we know for sure. And that is a standard that science can very rarely meet. That's a canard, really. That is not the way that we should be dealing with environmental policymaking. On the other hand, we can't assume that all risks are created equal, or that just because something poses a small risk, that it's something that we should change our lives about. We have to be smart about risk. Environmentalists, I'm proud to call myself an environmentalist, but we environmentalists have to be smart about risk also. I'm a journalist first, and journalists are trained... Science journalists are trained to follow the evidence. And those of us who are environmentalists also need to follow the evidence. And we should not assume that all risks are created equal. we should be smart about evaluating risks and looking at alternatives and making smart decisions where we can.
But surely, in a way, your story, Dan Fagan, the winner of the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation, in many ways, you know, there's a certain level of common sense as well. If you drink water that tastes weird and smells bad, that's your first clue, right? And it seems up like the first clue showed up even at the in the drinking founders at the very plant that we're talking about, the SIBA plant, because their water wells were the first to be contaminated. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I do think there's a lot to be said for following common sense. I don't think common sense can be the end of it. But common sense is a wonderful first recourse to say, this deserves further investigation. And certainly in Tom's River, especially in the early years, there was a lot of willful disregarding of common sense. And the reason is that people were enjoying the benefits of rapid growth. You know, for many years, Ocean County, New Jersey, where Tom's River is, was one of the fastest growing counties in the United States. And the real estate business was booming. People were making a lot of money, and those jobs at the chemical factory were wonderful middle-class jobs. You know, they were blue-collar jobs that paid well. And so there was a lot of sort of willful disregard of the long-term consequences of short-term actions. And, you know, that's eventually there was a reckoning.
Right, but normally we don't all make these kind of Faustian bargains, do we? We get a good job and a middle-class job, but by the way, your kids are getting cancer because the water is poisonous. I mean,
sure we do. Even in Tom's River, in retrospect, this all sounds very clean and easy. How could they possibly have ignored this evidence? But in the real world, it rarely works that way. Evidence sort of creeps up on us. It builds up over time. The state of the science was not nearly as good then as it is now, and it's going to be better 20 years from now than it is now. You know, now there are big debates underway about, say, you know, whether we should proceed with hydraulic fracturing, fracking, and to what extent should we do that, and what should the regulatory regime look like. And it's a difficult question, in part because natural gas, in some ways, is a very useful bridge fuel. I mean, if we had a rational energy policy, moving to decarbonize the energy system, personally, I would feel like, you know, using more natural gas, despite the many problems, you know, might be a sensible interim plan. We don't have a long-term strategy like that, so I don't think it makes sense. But the point that I'm trying to make is that everything looks clear in retrospect, and nothing ever looks obvious and clear while it's going on. And that's the case in Tom's River as well.
Well, but in the example that you gave, Dan Fagan, all of these things require somebody asking for or demanding a study. And in the case of fracking, still to this day, there's never been a comprehensive study of all of the leakage in the gas grid, all the way from the fracking fields and other fields through the distribution of gas and into the home itself. So
I think that's exactly right. And I think the people who make that point are making a very good point, and we need more data. Absolutely, we need more data. I'm not in any way saying that, you know, we should proceed full bore with fracking. Mm-hmm. In fact, since we don't have a sensible long-term strategy to decarbonize the economy, I do not favor fracking, period. The reason is that all we're really doing is postponing the inevitable hard decisions of you know, eliminating our addiction to fossil fuels, which we will have to do. It's just a question of when. But your point of look, we don't have good data on methane leakage and the extent of water contamination and also the tremendous amount of water that is required to frack wells. Yeah, we don't have good data. We need more data. All that I'm saying is that we never have enough data, and that the really hard decisions are what do we do with incomplete, in the absence of data, what kinds of decisions should we make? Environmentalists cite the precautionary principle, which is a very intelligent thing, in my opinion, but it is not the complete answer, because data will never be as complete as we would like it to do, as we would like it to be. There will never come a point when we know everything that we feel like we need to know to have perfect information about a particular action or particular environmental risk. The really hard decisions are all about figuring out what to do without complete information.
Well, I'm not an environmental reporter, but I do cover national security affairs. And years ago, when Ceausescu fell in Romania, I remember talking to a former one of the top people in the in their version of the KGB, the Securitate. And apparently, the Ceausescu and his wife would pore over the lists of all the dissidents in the country, and he would put a mark against certain names and write Radu, which means radiation. And what would happen is that individual would be called in by the secret police for an interview, and they'd sit in a waiting room for hours and hours to meet Colonel so-and-so. And then after several hours, a sort of sliding glass window would open, and somebody would say to the individual who'd been sitting there reading tattered magazines for hours and hours, obviously in a state of nervous tension, that you have to come back tomorrow. But all the while that they were sitting in that room, they were being radiated. So, and of course, Ceausescu and company were counting on the fact that nobody would make the connection between going to the secret police headquarters and ending up months or years later with terminal cancer. So that's, you know, the link between the cause and effect of cancer has, I'm not suggesting that SIBR is like Ceausescu, but it is a gray area that is clearly exploited.
Well, I don't know what you mean by exploited, but I mean,
well, it gives.
That's a horrible story about Ceausescu. Right. I mean, that's really evil. That kind of deliberate poisoning. That's not what happens in the cases that I'm writing about. What happens in the cases that I'm writing about is that companies do what companies do, which is that they try to maximize profits for their shareholders and increase their market share, and to do it as much as possible as they can within the constraints of the law. Occasionally, they go outside the constraints of the law. But even acting within the constraints of the law, there could eventually be terrible consequences. And that's what happened in this case. But it is certainly not the case that anybody set out to poison anybody else. That is not what's happened here. And I've been an environmental journalist for 25 plus years. And that is not the fact pattern. And I wouldn't want your listeners to somehow make that assumption.
No, and I certainly wouldn't want them either, because it's not the assumption, but it's the gray area that the heroes in your book had to fight, right? The nurses,
yeah,
the parents.
They said,
kids are dying, but nobody would listen to them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if your point is that it's very difficult to draw those lines between cause and effect, especially for a chronic disease like cancer, where you can have a latency period between the triggering exposure, you get a 5, 10, 15 years pass, sure, that makes it extremely difficult, and it makes it much harder for people to make their case, to reduce risk and to get the kind of social change that we need to make the world safer. So, yeah, if that's your point, I agree.
Well, in terms of that point then, just in closing, Dan Fagan, in terms of making the world safer, where do we stand? I mean, the head of the EPA was the governor of New Jersey, right, Christy Todd Whitman?
Well, she was not the head of EPA during most of the events described in the Toms River book. That actually occurred later.
Mm-hmm.
She was the governor of New Jersey during some key events that occurred in Toms River.
Right.
So in that sense, yes.
But in terms of her later tenure, has the EPA tightened up its rules, made it – obviously the state regulators are the ones in this case that needed a wake-up call.
Yeah, that's right. But this is a much bigger problem than just Toms River. I mean, I would hate for your listeners to come away from this thinking, oh, you know, this is really just about poor Toms River and the negligent New Jersey government. I mean, the only thing that's unusual about Toms River is that we actually found out about it. And we found out about it only through a whole fluky series of events, and also, as you alluded to, the determination and bravery of these families. So this is not just about New Jersey state government or a particular governor. This is a problem much bigger than that. I mean, in this country right now, we have a very hollowed out regulatory system. We're trying to manage environmental risk using laws that are 40 years old. And the agencies that are trying to do it are drastically underfunded. You know, we have a kind of a ruling ideology in major parts of this country that says that government is somehow the enemy, and so let's defund it. And then, of course, when you defund regulatory agencies, people get frustrated and they say, see, government doesn't work. And then regulation loses even more public support. So it's a real vicious circle. And what we need is updated laws, robust regulation, and, you know, most of all, Ian, what we need is campaign finance reform, because the long stall that we're in terms of environmental regulation in this country is directly related to this unending stalemate in Congress. And that stalemate is in turn directly tied to the influence of special interest dollars in Washington and also in state capitals. We've got to reduce the influence of special interest money in the system if we want to have any hope of intelligently addressing, collectively addressing, these very serious issues, whether we're talking about hazardous chemical exposures like what happened in Toms River and in many other communities, or whether we're talking about addressing global climate change, which is a collective problem that demands a collective response.
Well, Dan Fagan, I thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure being with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dan Fagan, who's a professor of journalism and the director of the Master's Level Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program at New York University, the former president of the Society of Environmental Journalists. He is the co-author of Toxic Deception, How the Chemical Industry Manipulates Science, Bends the Law, and Endangers Your Health. And he has just been awarded the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction for his new book, Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.